First, in 2015, a New York Times reporter spent a year documenting the lives of six New Yorkers. One was a gay man who had lost his partner a few years prior, another a Chinese immigrant with a love for playing mahjong, another an African-American veteran of World War II. What all six of them had in common was age. They were all 85 years or older. 3 years later, the experience is continuing to shape the life of the reporter. John Leland is a writer for the New York Times, and the title of his new book is Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you, in one interview, describe yourself as having been a gloomy Gus for most of your life. I want to give a listen to another one. Going back to the Seinfeld show, here's George Costanza growing a bit frustrated, talking to an older man at a diner. Maybe we relate to the situation.
Grateful for every moment I have.
Grateful? How can you be grateful when you're so close to the end? When you know that any second, poof, bam, oh, it could all be over. I mean, you're not stupid. You can read the handwriting on the wall. It's a matter of simple arithmetic, for God's sake.
I guess I just don't care.
What are you talking about?
So, John, a lot of us may think of old age with some dread, as George Costanza did there, some fear. That is not what you encountered as you worked with the people you were writing about for that year.
Yeah, I have to say I can relate to George in that, not in his tone of voice or his right. particular language, but I did have those questions, and I got more nuanced answers from the people that I talked with, and they explained how it was that they were getting on with their lives. They all had some kind of setbacks or difficulties, and they all acknowledged that they were near the end of their lives. But none of them defined themselves by whatever losses they'd had. They really all lived for the things that they could still do.
Yeah, and this is not kind of a Pollyanna-ish denying the problems with aging. It was how they dealt with them. What kind of lessons did you start to get as you spent more and more time with them?
Well, the big one and the overarching one from which all the other lessons flow, I think, is that whatever stage of life we're in, whatever hardships we've had, we have some say in what place we give them in our lives. We can make them the center of our lives and treat ourselves as that guy in the wheelchair, or we can think of ourselves as that father or that guy who likes to garden and happens to get around in a wheelchair. And the six people that I spent that year with all chose the latter. They just, I think, were reflexively drawn to it because, they don't expect their problems to all go away. They understand that there are problems, but they just don't want to live entirely in their problems.
I've talked to people who work with people suffering from Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, and I keep hearing, don't focus when you're talking to, say, a relative or other loved one. Don't focus on what's lost. Don't keep going to, don't you remember, don't you remember. Focus on what is still there, what you can still do with them. Is that a kind of lesson that you were getting from the people you worked with?
Yeah, exactly. There was a great study of Alzheimer's people or people with dementia in Britain a couple of years ago, and they gave the study the name, My Name is Not Dementia, because the people in the study didn't think that was the most important thing about them. That was just something they had, like brown hair or being tall or short.
Talking to John Leland, his new book is Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. John, can you share a couple stories from among the six people that you write about?
Well, the guy who first really got to me was Fred Jones. And Fred was the African-American veteran you mentioned. And Fred was 87 when I met him, and he was living alone in a walk-up apartment. And he was in the process of losing parts of two toes to an infection that was turning into gangrene. And his daughter was dying of breast cancer. When I said to Fred, what's your favorite part of the day? Fred would never hesitate. He'd just get this big smile and say, waking up in the morning and saying, thank God for another day, on my way to 110. And I'm like Costanza in that. I didn't get it. I'm like, how can you, what do you have to be grateful for? And how can you want another 20 or 25 years of this? And over my time with Fred, I came to understand it, that gratitude, it wasn't just like being happy because somebody gives you something or does you a favor. It was a different way of looking at the world and seeing the world as a benign place that gives you things. And more often than not, it's on your side. And the things that we have to be grateful for, as Fred understood it, far outweighed the the things that we had to regret.
Is it possible to cultivate that kind of mindset when you're not that age?
This is a great thing is that researchers who work with gratitude have tried this in experiments, and they'll just take ordinary people and say, why don't you try writing down three things you're grateful for in a day? And ask another group, why don't you just try to write down three things that happened to you in a day? And ask the third group, why don't you write down three ways in which you have it better than other people? And the people that just wrote down things that happened to them, you know, they were about the same at the beginning of the study and at the end. And the people that wrote down things in which they ways in which they had things better than other people, you know, had slight improvement. And the people who wrote down things that they were grateful for, they slept better, they exercised more regularly, they reported less stress or depression, they were more likely to do something for somebody else, for a stranger. And so, yeah, that was a short-term study, so we don't know what the effects of it long-term are. But at least in the short term, you can induce it deliberately.
Do you do this now?
I do. I mean, I don't have to do it deliberately because the time I spent with Fred, it just kind of worked by osmosis. And you have stories like Fred always cracked me up. He was that player. He's the guy who always had a dirty story or, you know, pretended he could speak German or wanted to tell me about the flashy suits he used to wear. And like the first time I met him, we went to the supermarket and he cruised the cashiers to see who was the prettiest before checking out. And at the same time, half his stories would be about his church and wanting to be involved in this church, and the other half would be about sex. It was just, I never grew tired of being with Fred.
You know, and the pop culture portrayal of an older person often is, I think, regret. Like if there was a character talking about the flashy suits they used to wear, it would be a sad moment. Like they don't have that anymore. You didn't get that?
I didn't. I mean, Fred wished he could still wear those suits, don't get me wrong. But he just moved on to his other life. This was what he was doing now, and he wanted more of it. He really was convinced he'd live to 110. I can say, alas, he didn't. He died in 2016. And I would mention that he died a week after his daughter died of breast cancer. And the social worker said he died of a broken heart. And I think that's probably true.
Now, going back to the beginning, this was just another assignment for you, right? You were going to go in, do this thing, write about it, done. You didn't expect this to change you.
I knew exactly what I was going to write about. I was going to write about the hardships of old age and how people fell down and then their life was over, or they got isolated from their families and they were depressed, or, you know, their memory started to slip. And I saw some of those things, don't get me wrong. Again, there was so much more to their people's lives, and their lives weren't problems that they needed to fix. They were lives that they were going to live with some difficulties, but just like anybody at any age.
And one of the people you talked to did have that injury. I think it was an injured ankle, was it? And had that fearful moment, like, is this the beginning of this downward spiral I've been worrying about?
Yeah, that's Ruth Willig, and she had a fall, and she dealt with her first fall, and then she's in a walking boot. And when she's in the walking boot, she had a second fall, and she hurt her hip at that point. And she thought, wow, this is the beginning of the end. This is how it ends. And that's a common thing. You know, if you're young and you fall down and hurt your hip, we think, how can you get better? And if you're old, we tend to think, oh, my God, this is the beginning of the end for Mom. And it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, but we need to remember that older people get better, too.
We're talking about lessons learned from older people from writer and author John Leland. He's the writer behind a New York Times piece that followed the lives of six people aged 85 and up. He shares the lessons he learned in the new book, Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you aged 85 and up? Do you have a lesson maybe to share with us? Or is there someone older in your life that taught you something important, maybe inspiring? Or do you look at aging with fear, maybe dread? Are there lessons that might help you deal with that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. John, we hear a lot that we've been sorting ourselves out in American society lately. We spend more time talking to people similar to us politically, ethnically, racially, and I'm guessing by generation. Do you think we need more opportunities to talk to people, spend time together, even if it's not a year-long reporting assignment, with people of other generations?
Absolutely. I have to tell you, this has changed my life more than any work I've ever done. It's just, it really did change me from ER into this annoying bundle of joy that you hear on your radio today. And we do. I mean, we always think, oh, older people need people to talk to them. But it works in both directions. There's benefits there in both ways. And going into this, my mother's 89, and I always thought, you know, what are the things I need to do for my mother? What does she need from me? And it's tiring to have a relationship that goes all one way. I love my mother, and I was happy to do it, but it's exhausting. And as I got to know the others and really understand that what they were giving to me without me having to try to solve their problems, it changed my relationship with my mother. So I began to appreciate all I was getting from her out of the time we spent together. And people that don't get to spend time with elders are missing something. I mean, for almost all of human history, societies turned to their oldest members for wisdom. And now we have this strange social experiment where we've stopped doing that because we'd rather look on Google.
I want to go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Stoughton. Bob, hi.
Bob is me.
Hi, Bob. What do you want to tell us about?
Oh, I was just telling the lady that I've been telling people recently that I'm 69, which we know we are, because you got to be 69 before you can be 94. But I have discovered that people treat me a lot different when I say, if they say how old are you, I just say 69, and right away, why they figure, well, he can carry that chair, or he can do this or that. They find out I'm 94, everybody thinks I'm crippled.
Really? So they talk to you completely differently if you knock, is that, 25 years off your age?
Yeah, they treat you a lot more normally. And when you get older, why they're afraid you're going to fall apart, I guess. Maybe I look bad, worse than I feel.
And so you do, obviously you're still having good conversations with people, even if you have to nudge your age.
We have a great time. I'm at Scallon here in Stoughton, and you couldn't find a better place to spend your time. It's really great. It's lots of people here, many, many people, and there's, you know, people come, people go, but it's really a good place to spend your old age. You're very highly respected here, no matter who you are.
Bob, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. I appreciate that. And John, you know, Bob says people here 80s, 90s and up, I think there's a stereotype. We build a whole story around that person that may not be accurate, that may affect the way we treat them.
Oh, my God. One of the things I heard most often was how annoyed people are by having younger people talk baby talk to them. Right. Oh, and how are we feeling today? Oh, 94 years young. Bless your heart. Hello, sweetie or honey. I've lived 94 years. I want to, you know, I've learned some things. I've seen some things. I'm not sweetie. I'm not cute. I'm not like, how old are we today? And you know, across the board, that gets people upset.
Bob, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go next to Pat with us in Madison. Pat, hi.
Hi. I had the opportunity for my mom and my aunt to move to Madison as they were approaching their 90s, so that I could look after them a little bit better. And I was so pleased that they were brave enough to do that in their upper 80s. And so they're both gone now, but what I really got from that was such an education and a kind of a gift that, you know, when you take time to really listen and have a relationship with somebody instead of just kind of doing for them as a caregiver, it's something that people who don't do it, they really miss out. And they were brave and they were, you know, reflective, and I miss them, but I actually kind of seek out a little bit of their old friends now, because it kind of rounds out my life. And I think people who don't take the step to maybe you know, they get fearful about being a caregiver or something like that. I think they lose a piece.
Pat, I think going into that, people might worry this is going to be a chore, a burden, and I'm sure it was a fair amount of work from time to time on your part, but you didn't go into it with that attitude of this is a burden on me, it sounds like.
I had no idea what I was in for, actually. I kind of thought, oh, it'll be good, it'll be easy because they're not going to be an hour and a half away. But, you know, I was retired, just freshly retired, and I was able to, you know, take the time, and that was my retirement, and I just embraced it and never resented it, and it's a great chapter.
Pat, thank you so much for sharing that story. John, what do you think when you hear Pat?
It's a really hard job, and I admire the caregivers so much. I mean, they're the heroes of this story, but it also is a much more rewarding job than people often think. And Pat's like, I love hearing that, how much she got out of it and how much the people gave her, even when you could look at it from the outside and say she's just doing things for them. It's not that way. She's learning from them and they're showing her how to be resilient. And not only that, who else is going to show you how to be old but somebody who's done it?
Pat, thanks so much for sharing your story. We're talking to John Leland. His new book is Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. I want to get the origin of the title, Happiness is a Choice That You Make. John, where did that come from?
Well, it came, the words kind of went into my head one day, and I wrote them down in a little piece of paper and taped it up by the side of my bed before I'd written a word of the book. And they were the first words I saw in the morning and the last words I saw before I went to bed. And I started to reflexively choose to be happy. I had my problems. My problems didn't change. Maybe they're a little worse than when I was younger or more severe than when I was younger. But I can just see through them now and put them in perspective. If I have setbacks, I don't take them personally, and I don't blow them up. I don't worry about things that might happen but haven't yet. There was a wonderful line from Jonas Mekas in it. He says, I never worry, because why worry about something when it's not happening? And then when it's happening, why worry? You deal with it. You spend all your time worrying, and it may not even happen what you think. And he says, nothing is hopeless. I don't even know the meaning of the word, hopeless. And he turned 95 on Christmas Eve, and I don't go a week now without quoting that line to myself. And this year especially, when the news has been so dark and really unpleasant a lot of times, it's been wonderful to have those words greeting me every morning and every night.
And John, I should say, this isn't just anecdotes. You also looked at research on happiness and aging, and yeah, surveys seem to bear out what you saw talking to this group of individuals.
Yeah, the studies have been consistent for years that older people are more content than, you know, as much as we idealize youth and hard bodies and firm skin, older people are more content, they're less stressed, they're less afraid of death. And a thing that's important is they're able to sustain mixed feelings, meaning that they can see the joy or the good in something even when there's pain or loss. And that's life.
And you talked about, you know, you were an ER before this. I mean, is it hard keeping up this attitude of gratitude, if I could use the phrase? Do you slip back into some of your pre-project ways?
Well, of course, I have bad days like everybody else, and some are internal, and sometimes bad things come my way. But as I say, when they do, I don't personalize them in the way I used to, and I don't overstate them, and so when those things happen, you get over them quickly. You don't get mad because it rained on a day that you had a picnic planned. You just say, well, rain, that solves. And all the older people were like that because they didn't expect things to go well for them every day. And so they didn't get, you know, knocked off their bearings when they didn't.
Can you leave us with just a bit of advice on how we get from maybe where we are now to a little more of that attitude?
Yes. Don't personalize your hardships. Practice gratitude. And don't treat things that haven't happened as if they have. And have some courage. I'm going to leave you with the story of Helen and Howie, who are one of the couples in the book, and they met in a nursing home. And they had the courage to love each other, even knowing that they probably wouldn't be able to do so for long, and one of them would probably watch the other one die. And I'm just astounded day after day by their courage. And this is the day after Valentine's Day. I salute Helen and Howie.
John, thank you so much for sharing that story and all of your reporting with us.
Oh, thanks so much.
We've been talking to John Leland. He's told us about lessons he learned from following the lives of six people over the age of 85. It started off as a, you know, usual reporting assignment, turned into something that he says changed his life. He ultimately wrote a book based on his work for the New York Times on this. The book is Happiness is a Choice That You Make, Lessons from a Year Among the Oldest Old. You can still share your stories, your thoughts on the wisdom maybe that you've gained while aging, the gratitude you have. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post or message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page.